Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Passports and Presidential Power Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 7, 2011, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in MBZ v. Clinton. This case presents two questions concerning U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem. First, whether courts have jurisdiction to enforce a federal statute directing the Secretary of State to, if requested, record the birthplace of such citizens on passports and consular reports as Israel. And second, whether that statute improperly interferes with the President's constitutional authority to recognize foreign sovereigns. To discuss the case, we have John Elwood, who is a partner at Vizen & Elkins Appellate Group. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Elwood.
The Supreme Court heard arguments last Monday in a case that presents fundamental separation of powers issues involving both the respective roles of the President and Congress in American foreign policy and the court's ability to resolve disputes between them. The question before the court was whether Congress can require the executive branch to list Israel as the birthplace of United States citizens born in Jerusalem. Since the creation of Israel, every president has declined to recognize Jerusalem as part of any country. With both Arabs and Israelis claiming sovereignty over the city, the United States has taken the position that the status of Jerusalem is to be negotiated as part of a Middle East peace deal. Congress, however, has tried to force a different policy, passing legislation in 1995 seeking to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and, in 2002, requiring the State Department to allow United States citizens born in Jerusalem to list Israel as their place of birth on their passports. President Bush, in a signing statement on the passport legislation, construed the provision as advisory, saying that it would otherwise impermissibly interfere with the president's constitutional authority to conduct the nation's foreign affairs. Both the Bush and Obama administrations have refused as a matter of policy to list Israel as the place of birth for U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem. Menachem Zivotofsky was born in Jerusalem 9 years ago, the child of American parents who emigrated to Israel. His parents applied for a U.S. passport for him, and when the State Department listed his birthplace simply as Jerusalem, with no country listed, the boy and his parents sued for enforcement of the federal law that allows them to list the place of birth as Israel. After some wrangling about standing that is not relevant here, the district court dismissed the complaint on political question grounds. A divided panel of the D.C. Circuit affirmed, holding that the State Department's decision to record the place of birth as Jerusalem and not Jerusalem, Israel, implements the President's exclusive and unreviewable constitutional power to keep the United States out of the debate over the status of Jerusalem. Judge Harry Edwards concurred in the judgment, agreeing with the majority that under the Constitution, the executive has exclusive and unreviewable authority to recognize foreign sovereigns. But rather than dismissing on political question grounds, Edwards would have held the provision unconstitutional and concluded that Zivotofsky had no viable cause of action. Zivotofsky sought certiorari to review whether the political question doctrine deprives a federal court of jurisdiction to enforce the passport statute. But when the court granted cert, it added a second question, whether the passport provision impermissibly infringes the president's power to recognize foreign sovereigns. The government maintains that the passport provision implicates the president's ability to recognize foreign sovereigns, granted by the Article 2, Section 3 power to receive ambassadors and other public ministers. Zivotofsky counters that the power to receive ambassadors is a ceremonial duty that does not extend to determining whether a particular city or territory is within the foreign sovereign's boundaries. He argues, particularly in his reply brief, that the statute is a valid exercise of Congress's power to enact legislation to regulate passports in furtherance of its powers over immigration and foreign commerce. But Zivotofsky's argument, presented by D.C. Attorney Nat Lewin, received a chilly reception at the court on Monday. Two members of the court, Justices Scalia and Alito, are alumni of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, which, within the executive branch, serves as the particular guardian of presidential prerogatives. Two others, the Chief Justice and Justice Kagan, are former associate counsels to presidents. But while former executive branch employees were particularly active questioners, they did not have a monopoly on skepticism about Zivotofsky's central argument for congressional authority to enact the statute as a regulation of passports. Justice Alito, do you think it's relevant that the title of Section 214, the relevant provision, is United States policy with respect to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel? Justice Kagan, It's a passport statute that seems to have nothing to do with the immigration functions that passport statutes usually serve. It seems to have everything to do with Congress's declaration of a foreign policy, as opposed to Congress's exercise of power relating to immigration control. Justice Sotomayor, what entitles Congress to trench on a presidential power that has been exercised virtually since the beginning of the country? Chief Justice Roberts noted that the statute singled out Jerusalem for special treatment and offered no similar provision with respect to citizens born in other disputed areas, such as Northern Ireland. Others expressed skepticism that what Mr. Lewin billed as an equal power for Congress and the executive appeared to give Congress the upper hand. Justice Ginsburg, you say foreign relations is a shared power. So if it is a shared power, why does Congress trump the executive? Antonin Scalia likewise said, it seems to me you are not arguing for a co-equal congressional power. You are arguing for a superior congressional power. Justice Kennedy, whose vote is closely watched in almost every case, asked what powers the president alone could exercise under the Zivotofsky's view of the law. Diplomatic communications, Lewin responded. In other words, Justice Kennedy said, with apparent incredulity, the president gets to decide who gets the telegram. Lewin tried to place this case within Justice Jackson's familiar tripartite framework from the Steele seizures case, saying that the president's powers here were at their lowest ebb when he was acting contrary to the express wishes of Congress. Kennedy said tellingly that he thought Justice Jackson's formulation assumed that congressional enactment was valid, suggesting he thought this provision was not. Justices from both sides of the ideological spectrum seemed to agree that the law could hamstring the president in sensitive situations. In response to a hypothetical from Justice Sotomayor, Lewin said that the president would have to wait for Congress to change the law if, as part of a peace accord, Israel gave up any claim of sovereignty to Jerusalem, causing Justice Sotomayor to say that the Zivotofsky's view would hobble the president. Solicitor General Don Verrilli received the warmest reception from the court when he stayed close to the narrow question of the president's power to recognize foreign governments, discussing specific historical precedents that supported his conclusion that the president has an exclusive recognition power. Verrilli ran into trouble, however, when he tried to maintain the president would have the same kind of exclusive power under various hypothetical situations. For example, if the statute permitted individuals to specify their birthplace truly as a matter of individual choice without reflecting any congressional judgment. Even former OLC Chief Justice Scalia voiced some discomfort with the Solicitor General's position that Congress had little role to play in conducting foreign affairs. It appears that the court's decision to add the second question could be outcome determinative in this case because there seemed to be widespread skepticism that the D.C. Circuit had correctly determined that the issue was a non-justiciable political question. Zivotofsky argued that this case involved a constitutional separation of powers question that was squarely within the competence of courts to resolve. Although Solicitor General Verrilli nominally defended the D.C. Circuit's decision, his defense was sufficiently lukewarm that Justice Kennedy observed, it seems to me you are not defending the rationale of the D.C. Circuit. Although Solicitor General Verrilli nominally defended the D.C. Circuit's decision, his defense was sufficiently lukewarm that Justice Kennedy observed, it seems to me you are not defending the rationale of the D.C. Circuit. Kennedy continued, it's always awkward for us to tell counsel what's in their best interest, but it does seem to me that your position would be much stronger if you said there is jurisdiction and the president wins. Kennedy continued, it's always awkward for us to tell counsel what's in their best interest, but it does seem to me that your position would be much stronger if you said there is jurisdiction and the president wins. Justice Sotomayor was clearly uncomfortable with the idea that the court would find the case non-justiciable, saying that it would be a little unsettling to hold that the president is entitled to ignore the Congress. Justice Scalia also suggested that the D.C. Circuit's outcome was incorrect, because saying that the president has preeminent authority in this area doesn't sound to me like abstaining because it's a political question. It seems to me like deciding the case. Although it is always difficult to predict from oral argument how the court will decide a case, the likeliest outcome to me seems to be that the court will conclude that the case is justiciable, but find the statute unconstitutional. I have to close by quoting one of the lighthearted moments in the case, even though it's already been widely reported. Nat Lewin, counsel for the Zivotofskys, argued that the statute was not a statement of U.S. foreign policy, but just a mechanism for individuals to identify themselves as a matter of individual choice, noting that someone born before 1948 could say he was born in Palestine rather than Israel. Justice Kagan, the youngest justice by 5 years, said, you would have to be very old to say Palestine. Lewin, who was born in the 1930s and who, like Justice Scalia, graduated from Harvard Law School the year Kagan was born, sputtered in mock horror, "Pardon? Pardon?" Justice Ginsburg, who was born in 1933, then delivered the line that brought down the House. Not all that old. A decision is expected by June, but I would guess March or April is more likely.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.